Welcome to the Wolfstead Podcast. I'm your host, Casey Dow. From farm to fiber, this is the podcast where we share the stories of shepherds, shears, fiber artists, and more. So if you love all things sheep and wool, this is the podcast for you. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm so excited to be back. I took a longer hiatus than I was originally planning, but we're back, and we're back with a new season and a new name. If you hadn't noticed already, what was previously the Dearly Woven podcast is now the Wolfstead podcast, and I'm so excited for our first guest for this season, Miss Rachel Hester of Whoopsie Daisy Farm. She shares so much goodness during this episode, from her story and journey into getting sheep and then starting to milk sheep. And then she shares about her new book, The Guide to Homestead Dairy Sheep. I'm so excited for you guys to hear her talk all about that and what inspired that. And the crazy thing is, she birthed her first baby and her first book all in the same year, which is just crazy and absolutely just amazing. And yeah, she shares so much during this episode. You can just really hear the enthusiasm and the passion behind sheep and homesteading just exuberate out of her during this interview. And I'm so excited for you guys to hear it. So hopping in here real quick, because I need to mention that you may hear a few baby noises during the episode that I wasn't able to edit out. I thought my little guy would sleep during the interview, but he had other plans. But I think it does add to the beauty of today's episode, as Rachel and I discuss mom life and farming during the interview as well. So just wanted to mention that before we got started. Now let's get into the episode. So much, Rachel, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Casey.
So to get started, now that we'll share with everyone that this is our third time trying this, and we're going to get, I've got a lot of glitches getting back into the whole podcasting world. But if you want to go ahead and get started and just share a little bit about yourself and how you got into homesteading, and then we'll talk specifically about sheep.
Sure. So my husband and I bought a foreclosed property, I think it was in 2017. And I had just graduated from nutritional therapy school. And while I was in school, I had read Omnivore's Dilemma and read about Joel Salatin. So I checked out The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer and Folks, This Ain't Normal. And I brought them home and started reading them out loud to my husband. And he was like, you know, I've always wanted to farm, but my family really discouraged it because they said there's no money in farming. You know, it's depressing. You won't like it. And he's like, but if I did it the way Joel Salatin does it, I think we would really do well at it. So we bought this foreclosed property. It was a definite not dream home. I mean, the previous owners had taken the kitchen sink, and there was no flooring. It was all subflooring. So we patched up the house together as much as we could just to live in it, and then we turned straight to homesteading. So we got chickens, and we already had honeybees, and we were trying to sell, you know, our grass-fed, organic, medication-free eggs to our local market. And there really just wasn't a market for our eggs at that point, just because everyone raises chickens in our area. It's a very homestead-rich area, although no one really uses that term. So in late 2019, we said, okay, well, let's do something different. Let's switch to four-leggeds. Let's start trying to do milk, because there's not a lot of, you know, pet milk or herd shares available in our area. So I wanted to do sheep for a while, but I, for some reason, thought sheep were much more difficult than goats, which is really not true now that I know more about it. But we were looking at starting a goat herd share, and I had wanted a breed of goat with really high butter fat. So I found the San Clemente Island goats, which are listed as critically endangered on the Livestock Conservancy. And we were all signed up to get our starter flock in March of 2020. But March of 2020 happened, and I don't know what happened to those goats, but they were no longer available. So everyone was panic buying toilet paper and pasta, and I went and panic bought two Border Leicester sheep. That's what was available. And my thought was, well, I know you can get meat from sheep. I know there's wool from sheep. And in my research on Border Leicesters, I kept seeing that they had historically been used for milk. And I remembered when I was overseas on the mission field, I had sheep milk cheese. So I was like, well, I can milk them if we're, you know, push comes to shove. So we brought these two sheep home on Mother's Day of 2020. And over the summer, my husband's like, I really don't think I want to do goats. I think I like sheep better. So we got our stimulus checks and I just kind of started collecting sheep. So by the end of 2020, I had the two Border Lesters, four Gulf Coast native sheep, which are listed as critically endangered in the Livestock Conservancy as well. And then I had two milk mutts. They were just a crossbreed of dairy breeds. And I wanted to use those as kind of like a control group to compare milk yield and butterfat content with the other breeds. So bred all of them. And spring of 2021, we had our first lambing and we started milking everyone, and the rest is history.
Why did you originally get the Gulf Coast native too? Like, what drew you to that breed?
Well, with doing research with the San Clemente Island goats, that just kind of, I got bit by the heritage breed bug, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I got on the Facebook boards and asked a ton of questions, and everyone who had raised Gulf Coast natives were saying they were really low input animals. And at the time, you know, I didn't know what the future held, but having low input options seemed very appealing for a couple different reasons. I mean, for starters, our homestead was not breaking even up to that point because of the inputs we had to do for the chickens, like with chicken feed. So to have an animal that really didn't need a lot of input as far as medication or supplementation or feed, that was just initially very appealing. And then not knowing what the future held, I was like, well, we kind of need an apocalyptic, you know, insurance just in case. So,
right.
And they were naturalized the American Southeast, which Kentucky is still kind of that region. And so since they had adapted to our local climate, I was just curious if they were going to need a lot of inputs that make shepherding very intimidating to people, or if they were kind of the answer to all of the angst I heard online about why you don't want to raise sheep.
Right.
So,
well, okay. So you got into dairy. How was your first year into, after lambing, how was your first time milking, and what was the variance between the different breeds?
So ironically, my Border Lester ewe was the highest producer of all of them. She also required the most amount of input, and she had the lowest parasite resistance. So we actually lost her last year to parasites, which we're still kind of bummed about. But I thought about sending the milk in for testing just to see what the like protein and butterfat contents were comparative to each other, and I didn't do that, and I kind of wish I had. But the Gulf Coast native milk was by far the absolute creamiest. Like, it was pretty much half and half in and of itself, which if you've ever had sheep milk, you know sheep milk is pretty creamy in and of itself. So the Gulf Coast also had the lowest amounts. I think the most I've ever gotten from them is a pint per milking, and you really have to manage the lambs where, like, you have to lamb share, and the second you pull those off, their milk production goes. So they were the lowest producers, but the highest butterfat content, and they were the hardest to train. Like, I think it took me a month to get them to where they would actually go up on the milking stanchion. Versus the Border Lester, I think within 3 days she knew what to do. She was very food motivated. So, and then the two dairy mutts, they actually already came trained, so it was more just kind of transitioning them from the milking stanchion they'd been on to our milking stanchion. So they didn't like the fact that they had to jump up on it, because the previous guy had one that was just flat on the ground, but neither my husband's or my back can really handle that. So we were like, no, you have to get up onto this table, because I can't lay on the ground and milk you. I'm sorry. This is not gonna happen. So they were kind of midline. Like, I think they would have given a liter, I think, if our pastures had been higher quality or we were giving them corn and soy. But I don't digest corn and soy very well, so we had taken them off the feed they were used to and put them on more of a seeds and less high burn or less high octane diet. So for us, they'll give us a really nice quart per milking, which if you go on dairy shepherd boards, like the snobs will be like, oh, that's not even worth it. But, you know, for me, for organic, free soy, free milk that grows in my backyard, I'll take it.
Right. And fun fact for everyone, the only sheep milk that I've ever had was Rachel's. And she was so kind to share some with me. And I was just amazed and shocked because it's literally like drinking melted ice cream.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would say it's totally worth it. And we're going to talk about your book in a second because your book has made me just, first off, after trying, sorry, baby fussing. First off, after trying your milk and then now reading your book, I'm just like, I think I could take on, you know, milking. We'll see how that goes. So I want to, you know, talk about the wool side of things and then we'll jump into your book. So get into knitting and crocheting. And then a lot of people don't think of dairy breeds of sheep as using their wool as well. So if you kind of want to hop into that.
Yeah. So I am actually at least a fourth generation knitter, maybe more. I'm not sure. My great grandma bought out 2 yarn stores at cost in the 70s. So I've just been surrounded by yarn my entire life. And then my best friend growing up, her mom owned a yarn store as well. So when I went over to their house to play, they actually owned 2 sheep and 2 llamas and about 18 Angora rabbits. So we were not allowed to play on the computer or Nintendo 64 or the trampoline until we had carted like a basket of wool. So I did take actual knitting lessons from them, but I don't remember learning how to spin. I don't remember learning how to card just because that was part of our growing up. So for me, it was kind of like just part of living, but I didn't really embrace it as something for myself until I got to college. And several of my dorm mates knit or crochet. So we would actually have study breaks knitting and crocheting together. And when I got married, my husband's family all just thought this was so weird / kind of cool, but mainly weird. So I just started trying to like convert them to fiber art. So I would make socks for like my grandpa-in-law, and he was like, I don't know how to wear this or wash. I'm like, you just wear it. Like, it's not hard. So I just kind of started becoming a wool evangelist, I guess. And my husband works in emergency services, so he works outdoors all year long. And when it's wintertime, you know, he'll wear my woolen knits that I've made him, and he's far warmer and healthier than all the other guys he works with. So and it also tapped into my frugality because my great grandma would give us yarn every time I went to go see her. And this wasn't like, I mean, there was plenty of acrylic, but she also would give me, you know, cashmere and cotton and wool and, you know, virgin wool. And so, you know, I would practice on the acrylic stuff, but I mainly gave that away. I really kept the wool high quality stuff for myself. So, you know, my friends would joke like, well, we would get you yarn, but you're a yarn snob and you only want that fancy stuff. And I'm like, I'm not a snob. I just like quality. So that was kind of my background with the wool and the yarn. And so when we got our own sheep, I mean, it was like, well, this is a ready supply of yarn for myself. Like, why wouldn't I use this? So I bought a drop spindle, and then 2 years later, I bought a used spinning wheel from my old spinning knitting mentor, my best friend growing up's mom. And then actually, a month after I bought her spinning wheel, she actually was killed in a car accident, which was very sad, but her kids didn't want her yarn store, so her husband ended up giving me all of her fiber processing stuff. So I inherited wool combs and carders and a drum carder and, you know, triangle looms and all these things that I never used. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm really, really, really going to do this now. Mm-hmm. It just didn't really occur to me to be a wool snob and not use what I had just because it was there and, you know, we needed wool socks. And so I was, I don't know, posting pictures and stuff and talking about it on Facebook, and people are like, oh, you're using your dairy sheep wool? That's really low quality because it's so scratchy. And, you know, I'd had plenty of merino yarn from all the stashes I'd inherited, and I've made things with the merino yarn. And like, you know, right now I'm wearing these fingerless gloves that are merino, and I've got a cardigan on that's half merino and half llama. And then I would make fingerless gloves and socks and stuff from the dairy sheep wool. And I just noticed, like, I can't wear these merino knits on the farm because they'll felt or they'll tear or they'll, like, they just won't hold up to it. But with the dairy sheep wool, I've got some fingerless gloves that I made our first year having sheep. So they're 3 or 4 years old and they're still going strong. So the coarser wools will actually hold up to more intense usage, which is what you need if you're on a homestead. Like, you don't want to have a really fancy, you know, scarf that you can't actually use. You want something that's going to go into the barn and come out with you alive. So I tell people when, you know, they ask about the wool, you know, isn't it lower quality? I say, well, it's not lower quality. It's just a stronger fiber. Like, it is a more coarse fiber. It's not a sheep that's been bred for fine wool production. It's a sheep that's been bred for fine milk production. And I mean, both wool and milk require protein. So the sheep is going to put its protein into good milk, and that's not going to necessarily be a soft wool, but that really strong coarse wool is great for socks and gloves and blankets and coats and, you know, outdoor wear and things you're actually going to use on a daily basis. And then you can go, you know, get your nice, you know, merino or blue face luster and make your, you know, skin to skin stuff with that if you want.
Yeah. And I think too, like what you're saying with the homesteading, you know, it's so important to have animals that are dual purpose as well. So if you can get multiple things out of one animal, I mean, goodness, you know, it doesn't. And as we know, as us sheep farmers know, those bags of wool add up super fast. So, you know, you can have your breed of sheep, but then, you know, if you still want some finer wool stuff and you want to hand process that yourself, there's so many sheep farmers that are like, sure, you can have a bag of wool and that lasts you so much longer than you ever anticipate. So
the amount of shepherds who are like, oh, you process fiber, do you want like 3 years of shearings because it's in my garage right now and I don't know what to do with it? My husband's like, no more, we don't want any more. And I'm like, of course we want it. Why would you say no? Yes, give us your whole barn full of Cheviot fleece. I'll take it. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I'll take it. So,
yeah, it adds up. And my basement is full right now. You can hand process it all, but it does take a lot of time. So sometimes I will save a bit. And I just took some to the mill last year and got my first batch of yarn back, which is great. And, you know, so I'm hoping to save a little bit more up to take some more to the mill and still keep my ones that I want to hand process. So have you taken any of your fiber to the mill?
I have. And actually, my spinning mentor would say she called one of her first businesses the Three Stitchers because she said it would take three of her kids to take wool from the sheep to a garment. So like one kid sheared the sheep, another kid washed it and spun it, and a third kid would knit it. And she would say, you know, really, you can do it all yourself, but if you're going to not lose your mind and like wool at the end of the day, you kind of need three different people to do those different tasks. So I did everything our second year. I sheared the sheep, I washed the wool, I spun it up, and I knit it into things just because I wanted that experience. And that was great before we had a baby. And, you know, I'm glad I did that just for the experience. But yeah, I did take wool to a local mill. And they did a really good job with the fiber itself. Their business practices were not what I would describe as stellar. So I am in the process of trying to find a different mill, which is a little trickier just because the Gulf Coast native fleece really needs babied a little bit if it's going to be machine processed. It's great for hand spinning, but it's not really for mass production machine processing. So you kind of have to find a smaller mill with someone you can talk to and describe the characteristics of this wool. The crossbreeds of my dairy mutts, like the ones that have Icelandic with them, I will hand process that just because I'll take that fleece, I'll just throw it in a tote and let it get rained on, and then I'll let it sit there for a couple days and rinse it out, and then I'll just spin it like that, which is actually a really ancient Icelandic way of processing wool called the Sweint method. And Sweint is actually the sweat of the sheep, and it has saponic properties to it. So if it interacts with alkaline water like rainwater, it'll actually turn into kind of a soap. And it won't get all the lanolin out of your fleece, but if it's a coarser fleece like Icelandic, you don't want all the lanolin to get out of it, because lanolin will actually soften and waterproof it. So I've been kind of playing with that, and I really prefer those fleeces to not be 100% scoured. So those fleeces I'll retain and just process them myself, just because, you know, I don't really think a mill is going to be like, yeah, I'll just let it sit out in rainwater and stink up the place, and then I'll spin it for you because it'll come out their machines as well. So
I'm jumping in here real quick to ask if you could pause today's episode and leave a quick rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, or share today's episode with a friend, or even if you're watching on YouTube, if you could leave a quick comment. Those are really helpful ways in getting the podcast out to other like-minded people. Thank you so much. Now back to the episode.
So let's dive into talking about your book. And like, when I'm sure when you first got started with dairy, I'm sure there wasn't a whole lot. There still isn't a whole lot that I can find about dairy sheep and, you know, the versatility of them and the ways to get started. So is that what gave you the idea to write your book?
Yeah, I kind of research the snot out of anything I get passionate about. So, which is a double-edged sword. Because then I get obsessed with it and then I talk about it and my friends are like, please just talk about something normal for a second. Yeah, I had been looking for more literature on dairy sheep, and there, like you said, there just wasn't a lot out there. There was, of course, the Olivia Mills Practical Sheep Dairying, which is out of print, and you can find it sometimes for less than $100, but typically you're going to spend $150 on it. So there's another book that's self-published called Eco Flock by N.S. Rose, and that one's really good. It's a really quick read, but it's packed full of information. But it wasn't really a, let me take you by the hand, new shepherd, and show you how to get milk from your sheep sustainably. So it was more of a book that said, like, here's why you should sustainably shepherd, and here's kind of what you can get as a result. So I had kind of been thinking, like, well, maybe I should write a book. And we were at Homesteaders of America, and I was at your talk, and, you know, people kept asking questions about sheep dairying, and I just didn't know there was that much interest in sheep dairying at that point. I thought it was just me and a couple other weirdos on our Facebook group. I went back to my booth, and people just kept coming the rest of that weekend saying, you know, tell us about sheep dairying. How do you get milk from sheep? How do you milk a sheep? And this one guy in particular came up, and he was just asking question after question after question after question. And I'm trying to answer them as fast as I can. And I guess he kind of realized he was interrogating me. And he's like, okay, well, where's your book? I'll just buy that and read it. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't have a book. And he's like, well, why not? And I was like, I didn't know anyone would read it. It was an interest. So, you know, he's like, okay, well, then where's your, you know, your YouTube channel talking about this? I'm like, nope, don't have that either. Rule internet's a bear. And he's like, well, then the pamphlet. Like, I need something. I'm like, okay, I'll work on it. Sorry. So I wish I'd gotten this guy's contact information so I could email him and be like, see, I did it. Now you can be happy. So he left, and we had been over to Shauna's daughter's booth, and they have these little pamphlets. And Kyle's like, you know, you could just write something over a weekend. You know, we'll staple it together. We'll print it at home. We'll charge like $5 a piece, and we'll just do like some basic sheep dairying stuff. And I'm like, okay, cool. So I went home and was like, okay, here's my outline. Here's what I want to say. And I was like, well, I don't have, you know, years and years and years of experience. So I'll just interview a couple of dairy shepherds and see what they have to say. And when I told them what I was doing, they all got really excited. And they're like, okay, well, how long is your book going to be? And I was like, oh, you know, 50 pages or something like that. And they're like, no, it needs to be longer. So I reached out to Janet Garman and I was like, okay, you're a published author. Like, what's the process? What do I do? How do I think about this? Is this even something I need to be thinking about? Cause I just found out I was pregnant. She's like, yes, this is needed. You need to do this. I want to help you. I'm starting a publishing company, so I'll just make you my first contract. And the rest is kind of history. And at one point she emailed me and she's like, Rachel, stop writing. You can write a second book. Like, this does not have to be a sheep encyclopedia. And I was like, oh, okay. So we capped it at 269 pages. And even then the designer was like, I don't know what else you could have fit in there about sheep. And I'm like, oh, I have whole files on my computer about more sheep facts. And he's like, oh my gosh. So it turned into a really nice little book. And then we're all very proud of it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Even just starting it, I'm just like, I want dairy sheep now. Like, there's information in there. You covered mm-hmm. so much on just the basics and everything mm-hmm. too. So it really is just such a great resource. I think for any shepherd, it's just a great resource to have on your shelf. It's very, very good. And yep, I'll be expecting book number two.
I know a friend of mine was like, Rachel, I think you need to have book number two ready by HOA 2024. And I'm like, oh my gosh, because I wrote the entire manuscript for this book within 6 months. And
wow.
I was pregnant. And so another friend of mine was like, I bet you're going to sign a contract for your second book. And then you're going to find out a week later you're pregnant. And I told Janet that, and Janet's like, if that happens, we're tearing up the contract. That was so stressful for all of us, guys. I'm like, yeah, I'm glad I did it once just to say that I did it, but I would not recommend it to anyone. And I don't think I want to do it again. So,
yeah, birthing a baby and a book in the same year is quite the accomplishment.
Yeah, my house is probably inventing the next pandemic because I have not cleaned it all year. So I just quit my bathroom for the first time this year.
Well, that kind of dives me into the next part I was going to talk about. How has life on the farm been with having your first baby and then, you know, finding that balance of having baby and farm animals?
Yeah, so my husband essentially took over the farm, which was challenging because I had been the main homesteader up to first trimester pregnancy. And if I got sick, whatever, he would fill in. But like I said, he works in emergency services. So, you know, I don't have a full-time job. I worked at our church cleaning just because we needed that other person's flexibility. So it's been kind of difficult because I did have a traumatic birth with this kid, and which really caught everyone off guard. Like, it really caught my midwife off guard too, because I've had such a healthy pregnancy. But I apparently have some issues with my hips. And he was sunny side up. So getting him out was a lot more challenging than we thought it was going to be. So recovery's been a lot longer than we expected. It's really kind of forced my husband into much more of a leadership role on the homestead than either of us were planning on, which has been good just because he hasn't had that, like, in his face view of what it takes on a day-to-day basis. Right. But it has really forced both of us to say, okay, we really need to quit making do with certain things and kind of refine some areas and then really look at other areas. So, like, we've really been trying to raise all our own meat birds, and we just decided this last year, you know what, we can support other farmers and buy meat birds from them. That's what we need to do. We don't need to raise our own meat birds. I had Angora rabbits, and I'm actually going to be, quote, loaning them, unquote, to some really good friends of ours, who are homeschoolers who want Angoras, and just, we're going to see how that relationship goes, and they may end up keeping them, which kind of breaks my heart because I love Angora rabbits. But I mean, we just kind of realize we don't need to be 100% self-sufficient at this point. We really need to garner community and be interdependent. So, like, what are the relationships we can build to foster community and help and not try to just be completely independent and self-sufficient? And before this, we had really been trying to just do it all ourselves. You know, we'll just stay up till 1 a.m. getting farm chores done. It's fine. And then we'll go work the next day. And you just really can't do that if you've got an infant and you're trying to breastfeed and all that. So it's been very challenging, but it's also been very good because we've had to ask for help a lot more than we ever had before. And the response has been really encouraging from neighbors and, you know, fellow homesteaders in our area who are willing to drive like a half hour or 45 minutes just to help us with some chores. Like, it's really been amazing to see how much the farming community locally has supported us.
We realize that too. I'm in a season of life where I do have two older kids and then the youngers. Even with that, we had to scale down. It just got, because you do, like, when your husband is off the farm full time, it's to be too much on them too. And you've got to find that right balance. And so reaching out, we signed up for a local CSA and, you know, that's 5 minutes down the road. It's such a blessing. And, you know, we're able to help other small farmers. You don't have to do it all. And building that local community, it really is. It's so important.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a friend of mine coined the term right sizing. Cause I was like, you know, we worked so hard to get this point. I don't want to downsize. And she's like, well, you're not necessarily downsizing, you're just right sizing. I mean, you know, you don't have to have 15 beehives. You don't even have to have any beehives. The Amish raise bees. You can go buy from them. You know, I'm like, you can build that network and right size for you, because even if it's a 5-minute chore of just checking the rabbit's water, that's one more 5 minute thing you have to think about and go do, and that's 5 minutes you're not putting your feet up. So, you know, we're learning that humility and to give ourselves grace, and like you said, take those blessings when they're offered.
Yeah. I mean, goodness, I feel like we could talk for forever. Yeah. I'm like, we really could, but let's move on to this question that I like to ask everyone. And then I'm trying something new, starting up the podcast, and it's a rapid fire question round at the very end.
Okay.
So we'll start with the question that I like to ask everyone. What is your favorite thing about raising sheep? And what is one piece of advice you would give a new shepherd?
Oh, gosh.
Sorry to throw it at you.
Yeah, that's like such a simple question, and it's not.
Yeah, it's a simple but complex question.
No. Okay, I think the most favorite thing about raising sheep has been I have really deepened in my understanding of how Jesus sees us because I'm a shepherd. I mean, I've heard so many pastors over the years say, you know, well, you know, all the prophets were shepherds because sheep are stupid and they had to stare at sheep butts to learn how to be a leader. And we are called sheep because we're stupid, and like all these very derogatory things towards sheep and owning them. It's like, no, I don't think that's it. I mean, yes, there are stupid sheep. Like, don't get me wrong. And sometimes they act in ways that you feel are very stupid, but if I spend time with my sheep and I really get to know them and understand them and they build that trust with me, you know, I don't think that's what the Lord meant. I mean, it's when all we like sheep have gone astray, like the first time my sheep went astray, it wasn't because they were trying to run away from me or be defiant or whatever. They just got really focused on eating the next thing in front of them, and they weren't looking where they were going. They just got really tunnel visioned on finding the next piece of clover. And they ended up in the woods, and like they had no idea how they got there. I had no idea how they got there. And so it was like this long thing of like they were scared. They were in this forest that wasn't familiar with. Like I was scared. There were snakes in the trees, which I didn't know was a thing in Kentucky. And I just had to be like, okay, you all can trust me. I'm going to get you out of here, but you have to trust me. And just they did eventually, and so I had to really die to myself and like control my tone of voice and look them in the eye and sound encouraging, and like even though I want to just scream and yell and stomp and throw a hissy fit and not go in the forest myself, showing them that strong gentle leadership of like, you have to trust me or you are going to die, those are your options, really just kind of opened my eyes to when the Lord tells us in scripture, like, thou shalt not, it's not because he's being a Debbie Downer. It's like, no, really, trust me. That's not what you want to be doing. So come follow me. I have a better way. Follow my voice. Do what I tell you to do and all will be well and you will thrive. And if you don't, it's just fact. You're not going to do well. So I think that's my favorite thing about sheep.
I love that because that's exactly how I felt when I got my sheep in the first, you know, couple months. I was like, wow. I said, I think everyone should own sheep so they can truly understand these scriptures in the Bible. There's just so many examples where he uses shepherd and sheep. It's so eye-opening owning sheep because you do get that, you know, real world example of it. So I love it.
Yep. And for new shepherds, I guess my advice would be read my book because it's all in there.
Love it. Promo here.
Shameless plug.
Yes. All right. Well, here we go with the rapid fire question. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Knitting or spinning?
Oh. That's not nice. Right now, knitting. My hips are messed up. There
you go. Lambing time or shearing time?
Oh, come on. I'll say lambing.
Yeah. Reading or listening to a book?
Dang it, girl. Reading. I'll say reading. I do love when my husband reads to me.
Okay. Mill spun yarn or hand spun yarn?
Hand spun for sure.
Sheep or chickens?
Sheep.
Okay, good. You got a
hand. I do love my chickens, but I don't name my chickens. I don't have a relationship with them. Like, I don't know whose clutch belongs to what chicken, and I know which ball goes to which sheep.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. That's a thing that I learned. I was like, wow, I can tell which sheep is who just by their baying.
Oh, I remember the first time it happened. My husband and I were in the house sitting at the dining room table, and I heard this baaing, and I looked at my husband, and I said, that's Mithril. She doesn't baa unless something's really wrong. You need to go check her. And he just looks at me like, how do you know who it is? And I'm like, just trust me. I know who it is.
See, the shepherd, you know your sheep, you know? Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yep. 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 But he knows the cow's moves. Like, she'll be bawling, and I'm like, what is going on? He's like, oh, she's in heat. I'm like, are you sure she's not stuck? He's like, oh, no, that's not her stuck move. I'm like, I trust you, but okay.
Yeah. It's like my kids with the chickens. They're the chicken people. If they're clucking a certain way, oh, they're just laying an egg. Oh, but if they're clucking a different way, oh, maybe something's after them. We better go check.
Yeah. Yeah, you learn your animals, but okay. Well, that's that was right. A great rapid fire.
Glad you liked it. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me and persevering since we had so many issues trying to get this going. But before we go, I would love for if you could share where everyone can find you, and I'll link everything down below and the link to your book and everything. But if you want to share your social media and website and all that.
Sure. My website is whoopsiedaisyfarm.com, and you can email me at whoopsiedaisyfarm@gmail.com. And then our Instagram and Facebook is @whoopsiedaisyfarm. And then we actually have a YouTube channel, which I have been informed by multiple sources I have to revamp. So I did post a video last week, and I've got to figure out rural internet because loading took 2 hours for that thing. So I'm going to try to upload a video like every other week, but we'll see. We'll see if my bandwidth can support that. So
we've got to figure out these. Yeah, I think all of us in these, you know, on farms, we all deal with these rural internet issues. Yeah,
I know. It's like we moved out to the boondocks to get away from all of this stuff. And now we got to figure out how to include it. It's so irritating.
Yeah, now we're like, okay, what's the balance between technology and living out in the middle of nowhere?
Exactly. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you again, Rachel. This has been so much fun.
Yes, always a pleasure, Casey.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. To check out more episodes and sheep content, you can head over to thewoolstead.com. Until next time.